I'm Jane Orient. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS. You can see our sign up there and our website. We were founded in 1943 to fight the Wagner-Murray-Dingles bill. That was Dingles the elder, not the Dingles the younger, who was responsible, partly responsible for the current bill. We fought the Clinton bill, we fought Obamacare, and we're to continue to fight this idea until it dies. We do not come to Washington with our hands out. For one thing, we know that the government doesn't have any money. We are here to talk about the people who are not on those organizational charts that you see, namely the patients and physicians. Patients are supposed to be what the whole enterprise is about, but I challenge you to find them anywhere on those charts. We do defend private medicine, which is distinct from private practice, which has to do with the ownership of the means of production. But private medicine has to do with who the doctor is working for, which should be the patient. If you would like to learn more about us, please go to aapsonline.org and sign up for our email alerts. I really want to thank Congressman Burgess for coming. He is the author of The Doctor in the House. He is the doctor in the House, and he is here to defend the interests of patients and physicians. He is serves on the House Energy and Commerce Committee and is vice chairman of the Subcommittee on Health, and he is now the chairman and the founder of the Congressional Health Caucus. I think he understands that the issues have to do a lot with freedom and with the patient-physician relationship and not just with abstract economics. So on behalf of AAPS and our 5,000 physician members and all of our patients, we welcome you and we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, you know, I get a confession to make. I mean, Dr. Orient has always been one of those people that I've looked up to. We started practice about the same time back in the early 80s. And I remember well going through the Clinton healthcare years. I was not politically connected or politically motivated at that time. I was a young OB-GYN doctor working the typical 12 to 14 hour days, trying to take care of my patients and take care of my family. I could have cared less about what was happening up in Washington, D.C., until one day I realized that what was happening up here could be significantly to my detriment if I was not involved. And the point of the Great Awakening for me occurred when, in their infinite wisdom, of course, the Clintons were so fearful of a two-tier system, as has developed in some other countries with nationalized health care, that they wanted to be sure that the private practice of medicine, the private ownership of medicine, was completely dead in this country, and therefore they decided there would be a penalty for anyone who saw a patient and rendered treatment outside of their system. In other words, criminalizing the very activities that I was involved in for 12 to 14 hours a day. That got my attention, and I credit that with, again, my political awakening and the great story, and I don't even know who to credit it to first, but Dr. Orient fought fiercely against the secret panel that then First Lady Hillary Clinton had put together to discover a way to put health care in front of the people of this country, and locked 500 lawyers in a room and behind closed doors, they were going to figure out how to pay doctors. And so my mission coming to Congress was to at some point lock 500 doctors in a room and set legal fees on their basis. I've not been successful in doing that, and sometimes I even threaten economists. I just got to share this too with you. We would have these panels while we were dealing with the so-called hearings leading up to the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, and we'd always have a panel of three economists, perhaps two people had been harmed by the healthcare system in some way or other, but never a doctor on the panel. So I would also threaten the economists that someday we're going to have doctors come up here and set your value as well. But we are where we are with this thing, and it is, in many ways, it's truly a frightening and perilous time for the country. You are hearing up here now a lot of discussion over the issue of federal spending and what is going to happen because of the fact that last Monday at 12 o'clock noon, we reached our borrowing limit and can no longer effectively borrow money. Now the government can continue to run by a sort of shell game that Timothy Geithner is staging right now, but at some point we are going to have to come to a national reckoning with this. In my opinion, and I am not involved in any of the discussions, I am not involved in the leadership of my conference, I am just a single member of Congress representing 900,000 people back in North Texas. But in my opinion, if you do not include this in the discussion about what you do for the deficit, then you are not being serious. And this was the great objection I had to the President's Deficit Reduction Panel last December. They came forward with some ideas, some of which I have embraced in the past, but they, for some reason, felt that this was off limits and that they could not touch the President's signature issue. There's no question about it. Entitlements are a raging fire when it comes to the federal expenditures, and it's getting worse. But this represents a gasoline tanker that is fixing to dump its contents on that fire and send it through the roof ever and ever higher. If you do not control this at its start, you'll never be able to control it after 2014. So that is why it is so critical that we continue to fight this monstrosity that is before us. Now, just a couple of issues that I did want to bring forward with you, and you will see these things talked about on the floor of the House for the remainder of the summer. There is hidden within this law, that is now law, the funding for the implementation is carefully scattered throughout the language of the actual legislation. And as a consequence, this thing is full of what I like to call post-dated checks. These are checks that are actually overdrafts. They're already overdrawn because we're borrowing 42 cents out of every dollar that we spend. So any additional dollar that you spend is clearly just deficit spending. So these blank checks are hidden, post-dated blank checks that are in fact overdrafts are hidden in the bill. One of the things that is incumbent on this Congress to do right now, even though we just have, as the Speaker says, one half of one third of the federal government under our control, it is still our job to try to dig those checks out of this legislation and tear them up and put a stop payment on them before they can do further damage. Now, we all know that there are court challenges to this. I will tell you, in March of 2010, when I was sat in front of TV cameras and a microphone was put in my face about what do you think about the Supreme Court striking this down, I said, look, if you're waiting for the Supreme Court to save your bacon, it's probably too late. We need to stop it before it gets to that point. We didn't. So now the Supreme Court looks very attractive to me, and I am encouraging, of course, I would like to see this expedited to go through the Supreme Court, but the appellate process, we learned a couple of weeks ago, will not be expedited, and as a consequence, we have to wait till essentially a year from now before the court will rule. Likely at the end of its next term, which will be June of 2012, which is a long time to wait. So many people they consider it an affront that they have to continue to spend money on something that they do not know if in fact the courts are going to allow to stand. That's why it's so important for us to dig those post-dated checks out of here and again tear them up and put the stop payment on them. The ultimate referendum on this, even if the Supreme Court does not provide us clear direction over the next year's time, the ultimate referendum on this will be November of 2012. And whether you like anyone who is running for the Republican nomination or not, whether you like anyone who's running for a third-party nomination or not, the sad fact of the matter remains that if Barack Obama is elected to a second term, guess what? This is the law of the land for the rest of our natural lives, and there's no way around that. If President Obama finds himself to be a single-term president, the next president, whoever he or she may be, whatever party they represent, I rather suspect one of their first official acts by April of 2013 will be to sign the legislation that repeals this. And I really do think it is just the choice will just be that stark, that up or down. November 2012 will be the referendum on this. What if the president retains his position and Republicans keep the House and take over the Senate? You're not going to get it done. This is going to require a concerted effort by both the legislative branch and the executive branch to get this undone. The courts could also rule, and the courts could rule in about a year's time, and we might see a court-ordered restructuring of this or a court-ordered de-implementation of this. All of that, again, becomes terribly complicated. My challenge to Secretary Sebelius when she came before our committee, Judge Vinson down in Florida wrote in his opinion that an injunctive release that the Attorney General sought, in addition to the declaratory judgment which he granted, injunctive relief was not necessary because officers of the federal government will adhere to a lawful order of the courts. The body language, the facial expressions of Secretary Sebelius told me that morning when I posed that question to her was they had no intention of behaving as Judge Vinson had instructed. And as a consequence, it really is going to take both legislative activity and it may well take a national referendum and the voice of the people to be heard once again to issue a referendum on this. Do I fear for the future of medicine? Absolutely, I do. And so many of the things that we talk about now don't even have to deal with the nuts and bolts of a doctor and patient in the treatment room. They deal with all of the other exigencies of the regulatory regime that is now being imposed. Take the issue of what are called accountable care organizations. Now, whether these are good or bad, whether these turn into the 21st century, the version of the HMO of the 1990s, is anyone's guess. But in my opinion, for an ACO to be successful, it must be owned and operated by doctors, because the doctor's fundamental contract is with the patient. If the ACO is owned by the hospital or the health plan, then the doctor works for the hospital or the health plan, and the patient is just a necessary inconvenience along the way. If the ACO is going to be viable, it must be under the ownership and control of physicians. Unfortunately, the rules are set such that the capital requirements for setting up an accountable care organization likely exclude most physicians' practices from being able to do that. The other thing now, of course, now that the rule has been written and the pages and pages of regulations have come out, even groups of doctors who run an integrated practice who used to come to me and say, we really like the ACO model, we think it's a way to hold down costs, now they are coming to my office and saying, we cannot function under the conditions set forth for us by the administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Just a word about the administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Don Berwick. He has yet to come to our committee, although Dr. Berwick and I have had several conversations about this and ACOs and other things. A very learned man, a very smart man. We disagree. We're about 180 degrees out of phase on a lot of things. But whether you like Dr. Berwick or not, if he is truly the person to implement this, unfortunately, he has a shelf life. Dr. Berwick was put in as a recess appointment a little less than a year ago, and as a consequence, his term will expire in December of this year. The Senate does not like recess appointments and will not confirm someone who has been put there on a recess appointment. So Dr. Berwick is a time-limited commodity within the Obama administration. So I've said probably more than you wanted me to say, but I'm anxious to hear from the other panelists, and then we'll be around for a few questions. As one last thing on Dr. Berwick, dealing with the issue of end-stage renal disease and nephrology, I told Dr. Berwick I would believe that CMS is serious about what it is, what its stated goal of trying to really integrate the practice of medicine, when it understands that when someone who's been on the end-stage renal disease program receives a transplant, you cannot now ignore their anti-rejection drugs and safely expect them to stay off of the end-stage renal disease program in the future. And that's a sort of circuitous thinking that goes on over in the federal agencies that, to me, is sort of the poster child for why this sort of thing never works. You need to leave the doctor in charge of the patient's care. There, I've said enough. I'll be quiet and listen to the other panelists.
So I learned about single-payer socialized medicine. So after I got out of residency, I worked for the VA. I was on the tenure track. I was doing rounds with students, which I really loved. And it was really an excellent job. I got paid $50,000, which was not bad back in 1976. I've certainly never earned more than that after going into private practice. And I had all my weekends and federal holidays, of which they were quite a lot, free. Didn't have to pay for malpractice insurance. My coworkers were very good. There are very good people working for the VA. I liked the veterans. But I could not take care of them properly without breaking the rules. I was supposed to basically kick them out if they weren't eligible for treatment, and most of them weren't, or at best refer them to somebody else in the clinic like 3 months into the future. The other thing was that you really couldn't do better at the VA by working harder. Your paycheck was determined by what your GS level was, and it came every 2 weeks pretty much regardless of whatever you did. And it was a very bad idea to work too hard, because if you did, people resented you. And also, the more you do, the more likely that you are to make a mistake and the more things that you could be blamed for. Also, that you were constrained in what you could do, what consultants you could use, what drugs you could prescribe, what treatments you could use, and what you could say. I mean, you, as a VA doctor, you cannot criticize the government, for example. And this is beginning to be a problem for me. The mechanism for dealing with problems was we had an administrative meeting once a month, and we'd all sit around in the conference room so we could let the administration know what our problems were. Well, one day, a nurse practitioner had a brilliant idea. Let's just take the tape recording of last month's meeting and play it in the conference room, and we'll all go to the canteen and have coffee, and exactly the same thing will happen as far as taking care of our administrative difficulties. But people got along there by getting the VA attitude, and I was getting that attitude, which I didn't like very much. So I got out of there as soon as the opportunity presented itself. I made less money, I had more expenses, and there were no two-hour lunches at a restaurant. I ate bagels and peanut butter in my office, but I would never, ever go back. I practice private medicine, and I don't take insurance. We never ask patients what insurance they have, and the totally uninsured patients are my very favorite one. I actually read the contracts that third parties were asking me to sign and found out that I was really beholden to them. I was their serf. I was responsible for financing the patient's care if this big billion-dollar enterprise went bankrupt. And the doctors were usually in a conflict of interest because if there was capitation, or there was a withhold, or there were so-called bonuses, or there was gain sharing, I think is the new idea, the doctor lost. He had to pay for this. He might actually be punished by getting kicked out of the list, which could destroy his whole career, because he was not efficient in utilization, which meant protecting the entity's bottom line. So I found that I really had no, with managed care, I would have no more power over the system than a VA doctor does. If you tried to advocate for the patient, there was still a bureaucracy that could punish you. And another thing that was very much worse in managed care was you didn't get that automatic paycheck. You had to fight with somebody to get paid. And they could withhold your pay, or they could claw it back, or if it's the government, they could even put you in prison because you made a mistake in the coding. So I found that in my practice, dealing directly with the patient eliminated all of these layers of bureaucracy, all of these threats. It was very much less expensive. And there was true payment for value and payment for performance. It's just that the person who assessed those was the patient. If the patient didn't think he was getting any value, well, he went somewhere else. In my opinion, that most medical encounters should not be covered by insurance. Insurance is for catastrophic losses, and the person who should get the benefit of the insurance is the person who paid the premium, namely, in the case of medicine, the patient. The government talks about administrative simplification, which, you know, consists of piles and piles of regulation. But true administrative simplification is not to have to deal with any third party for routine bills. It's kind of like at the grocery store or at the auto mechanics. The patient asks how much it is, you tell them, and you collect the money, and that's that. You get paid for providing a service that somebody values, not for providing a clean claim with code numbers on it to the insurance company. And patients are very sensible about how they spend their money because they're the ones to benefit from the economizing. I mean, there are many examples that physicians can give you about patients who are willing to accept thousands of dollars worth of services paid for by somebody else. But if they have to pay $20 for those same services, all of a sudden they find that they don't really need them very much at all. Direct payment is also the ultimate end to fraud, because fraud is self-revealing. Those patients look at their bill, they know what you did and what you didn't do, and they know whether it was any value and whether it was provided to them or not. So to have a direct relationship between the patient and the physician is the key to efficiency. And it's also the key to caring about the patients. And I think that's one reason why Berwick and other advocates of third-party medicine or accountable care organizations want to get rid of the patient-physician relationship. Because if the patient is nothing more than a warm body on the assembly line, you don't really care about them, so it doesn't bother you when you do the things that save the system money by denying that patient the best medical care. In all of these things that are supposed to improve all this efficiency are, in many cases, just myths, like this interoperable medical record system. That's for enabling control of the physician, not for better treatment of the patient. It's much better, it's much easier to take care of a patient that you've seen before. If a new patient comes in, I don't get the information of him just by putting my hand on this electronic medical record. It doesn't just come into my brain. And the only information I have to work with is what's between my ears. And the only way you can really get to understand a patient is to interview the patient and to lay hands on him yourself. This doesn't come from the record. So, you know, we just really can't circumvent that. And to make the patients and the doctors interchangeable is very inefficient, as well as very costly and very detrimental to the quality of care. It's much easier if you don't have a relationship with the patient to just to abdicate responsibility to the next guy who comes on duty. So when we talk about healthcare reform, we're talking about something very different from what the government's talking about. They really want to destroy private medicine. And the whole idea of an accountable care organization is to do that. And it's nothing more than glorified managed care. And they want to change the payment method. You have to payment for outcome instead of activity. Well, if you don't pay for activity, in other words, if you don't pay for work, what do you think people are going to do? You know, they're going to work less. The advocates talk about fragmentation, but what ACOs and this whole reform bill does is it subdivides patients. It slices and dices them into various groups and to various disease classifications. The management is supposed to be carried out by a team, which is mostly non-physician providers, which has to be because there aren't going to be very many physicians anymore. And the ACO is supposed to go by the 65 quality metrics that were dreamed up by somebody at CMS. It's sort of, they have the assumption that if you get everybody's numbers under this narrow range, like their hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of their long-term blood sugar, or their blood pressure, or their cholesterol, that we're going to have better population health in the long run. And that what they're concerned about is this abstract thing of population health in the long run. But, you know, I can't keep track of all of these numbers at the same time as asking the patient in front of me what's bothering her that day, because those may be very, very different. And if we do all of these preventive activities, which is all this about, we won't have any time left at all to see to the, what the patient's needs are. Most of the outcomes for the patients really aren't under the doctor's control. The only one that might be is, you know, like letting him die sooner. And so if we're paying for outcome, the only way the doctor can improve his chance of paying his bills is to manage the case mix and get in his practice the cooperative patients, the ones who aren't very sick to begin with. So what's going to happen with this bill is there's going to be a great increase in compliance costs. Many physicians in small practices will not be able to meet them, and they will have to leave practice and go to work as a salaried employee of the hospital or get out of medicine altogether. It's going to shift resources from caring for the sick into the population health, which may or may not have any advantages in the long run, but it's certainly very costly in the short run. There will be physician shortages simply because insured patients demand much more services. This has been demonstrated over and over again. The average age of physicians in many areas is older than 55. Many of them are likely to retire early rather than to make the huge investments that the ACO will require. An Investor's Business Daily survey said that 45% of them were going to retire if this act went into effect, and that is really and says about the same thing as the surveys that AAPS has done. So I think that the answer is private medicine with patients caring for patients. That's the only way to save money. Also, we have been called dinosaurs, but remember, dinosaurs are big, clumsy, voracious things that eat up everything in sight and trample on things. And that sounds to me like the definition of an ACO. Physicians cannot practice medicine like a doc in a Skinner box, where we're trying to go through all of these bureaucratic mazes or push the little levers to get the codes right in order to collect a food pellet. We just can't do that. The only way we can practice medicine is by dealing firsthand with our patients. And we practice for the love of the art, and for the love of humanity, in the words of Hippocrates, not to get these rewards from manipulating the system. But under this, the act, that's the only way physicians could survive. So we do not want to replace the practice of medicine with a heartless, calculating, collectivized, depersonalized, monstrous, uniform healthcare delivery system. There might be people in white coats working or pretending to work, but your doctor will not be in. And so I think that we really need to get this thing defunded and ultimately repealed. Real reform means getting the government and other third parties out of the practice of medicine and getting things back to the patient and the physician. And to tell us more about that, we have Dr. Richard Emmerling. If you read the Wall Street Journal, you will have read his letters to the editor. He practices nephrology at the Beth Israel in Manhattan and is also a director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons.
First of all, I am coming at this from the perspective of a full-time hospital employee. So I want to tell you right away for the record that my views are my own and do not reflect the views of my employer. They actually wanted me to say that before I started here. So, you know, after graduating from medical school, you are not actually a doctor, though you have MD after your name. You have to go through years and years of what we call residency training. And in residency training, that's where you actually learn to function as a doctor. And even though the hours and the conditions are vastly improved now, as opposed to when Dr. Orient and I did our, and Dr. Burgess, did our residency, those were we refer to as the days of the giants, right? Mm-hmm. It's still a very arduous and challenging period. And now, traditionally, after this apprenticeship, where doctors, where the residents would get a sort of a little salary to keep them alive, they eagerly looked forward to getting out of the residency scene and starting their private practice or joining an established private practice and practicing medicine, taking care of patients. Unfortunately, over the last 10 or so years, there has been a real change in this, and more physicians who graduate residency are looking to stay on in some capacity within the hospital system or within the hospital-run clinic system, either as what we call a hospitalist, which is a full-time person who gets a salary to see patients who are admitted to the hospital, or as a teacher or an administrator. Not only that, but now over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years, we are seeing a mass migration of doctors out of their established private practices and back into the hospital to work within the hospital setting. Now, according to Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who was also a frequent contributor at the Wall Street Journal, in 2005, doctors owned more than two-thirds of medical practices. But by next year, 2012, over 60% of doctors will be salaried employees, and a third of these will be working for hospitals. Also, nearly 50% of jobs listed in a big recruiting firm are for hospital jobs, and that's up from 25% 5 years ago. A recent report in Renal Business Today quotes a Medical Group Management Association survey of 58,000 physicians, and they found that 55% of practices were hospital-owned in 2009, up from 30% 5 years earlier. So this is a major trend, and it has been barely commented on. So what is behind the trend, and more importantly, what are the implications of this for patient care? So clearly the largest driver of this mass migration is money. Practice expenses are rising and have been rising every year with inflation or even faster than the general inflation rate, but the reimbursement rates from the third-party payers, such as Medicare and Medicaid and other third-party payers, have not kept pace. Another survey from MGMA from 2007 found that overhead costs exceed 60% of practice revenue on average. And medical malpractice premiums in some specialties have gone up by 10 to 20% annually. However, the third-party payments have either been cut or have not been increased, which is the same thing as a cut given the inflation that's occurring over this time period. So the financial pressures by the third-party system, not only have they eroded the quality of care by forcing doctors to increase their practice volume to the point where they can't possibly deliver the same quality of care, but they're actually literally forcing independent practitioners out of their practices and into the walls of the hospital where they are running for protection. Now, the passage of the PPACA, which is, of course, a misnomer because it doesn't protect patients and, in fact, increases costs, that certainly accelerated this trend. Doctors are looking at increasing regulation, reporting requirements, the mandatory e-prescribing, mandatory electronic health records, all coming at them. And they're saying, no, I can't do this. Even when the HIPAA law was passed, a lot of doctors said, this is too much for me, I'm closing up shop. So this is causing doctors to either consider early retirement, or those who are still interested in practicing medicine, they are looking to move into the hospital system where they feel they can get some protection. So what are the downsides of this? Well, Dr. Orient has discussed already several of them. Let me look at a few others. And the first is the loss of the fee-for-service model of payment. So let's go back to our medical and surgical resident. I think it's a good example. Now, these folks, and I was there once, and we were all there, we get paid a small salary as a medical resident. That salary doesn't change with your effort, okay? So every additional minute that you work doing something that you're perhaps not absolutely required to do erodes your hourly wage. Now, this leads to what I have observed as a nearly universal attitude among residents and house officers to avoid doing any extra work at all. This does not include moonlighting, where they get paid separately and they line up for moonlighting opportunities. No, this means their actual residency work, admitting patients and seeing patients and doing bloods and IVs are much less now than when we did our residency. So the obvious manifestation of this is what we call the TERF. And this is where residents will attempt to have either a new admission or a very difficult patient transferred or discharged to another service, get them off of their hands, if you will. Let me give you an example of the classic TERF, and this has become a legend. This story has become a legend, but it is actually true that many years ago, a resident who was on call at the NYU Bellevue emergency room, which was really one of the busiest emergency rooms in the country probably, got called at 2 a.m. to come down and see an 80-plus-year-old guy who was very emaciated. He was obviously septic with either pneumonia or urinary tract infection or both. He had liver disease, he had kidney disease. In other words, he was a train wreck. And this resident knew that he was going to be up all night with him, just getting him squared away. He was going to wreck his night, and he was just about ready to go and get a few winks. So he has an inspiration, and he asks the patient, did you fight in the war? And he manages to come through his cloud, and he says, yes, World War I. So immediately he ships him over to the Manhattan VA hospital, which is right across the street, goes up to his on-call room and goes to bed. About 30 minutes later, he gets a call from the emergency room, and the ER resident tells him, right war, wrong side. So he had to come back down and take care of that patient. There's no question that if doctors get back into the hospital system and they're on a salary, this turfing, if you will, is going to become common fare. Now, the only way to cure this kind of behavior is the fee-for-service model. In fact, I've proposed this at our hospital as a way to compensate residents. That would stop their griping. You know, if they're going to get an extra $25 or $30 to get up and see a new patient, they're going to jump. And that's what happens. Fee-for-service ensures prompt service. It ensures that patients get cared for in a timely manner. It aligns the payment with actual work, actual activity on behalf of the patient. And medicine is hard. This is something that most people don't appreciate. Taking care of patients is very hard work. It's emotionally draining. It's physically hard work. And there ought to be a reward for doing it. And as soon as you take that reward away, the work performance falls off dramatically. Now, fee-for-service has been blamed for runaway healthcare spending. That is not true. What is to blame for runaway healthcare spending is this third-party payment system, which is unlimited by co-payments or by participation in any way of the patient. So the patient feels that this stuff is all being paid for by somebody else. They have no qualms about asking for everything, and they expect to receive it. Likewise, the physician who's under some pressure to not miss anything because the malpractice attorneys are going to jump all over him, has no pressure not to do things. So that's where the overuse and the overruns in costs come from. It's not the third party, it's not the fee-for-service system. So let me give you another example. At our hospital, when I was first there for the first 15 years or so of my stay there, the radiology physicians, radiologists, who are extremely competent, very highly trained people, were on a strict salary. Well, it was very hard to get studies done. And they left promptly at 5. Reports were usually a week in coming to you. And it was kind of bad. Well, an enlightened director took over that service, and he instituted a fee-for-service incentive program for the radiologists. Well, overnight, the system turned around. They were eager to do studies. They never said no. The reports would come back to you the same day, within hours. You would get a fax or an email with a report. And when you go down to talk to them about a case, they were friendly. You know, their whole attitude changed. So this is the sort of thing that differentiates a salaried type of physician from a fee-for-service physician. Now, what about hospitals in general? Hospitals are really not good places to work. They're very inefficient. The administrative sector in hospitals grows continuously and crowds out the actual productive sector of the hospital, which are the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the people that make it work. The administrators don't create any value, but you would not guess that by looking at their pay scale. And this clearly is not approved by my hospital. Okay, I'm on thin ice here, and I may not have a job by the time I get back at this rate. Each year, when I make rounds, I notice more and more people hanging around the nursing station. I don't know what they're doing. I know that they're getting paid. It's starting to remind me of the TSA. So things could be streamlined, but they won't be because it's the union involved with healthcare workers, which in New York is 1199, which is part of SEIU. I don't know if you know that. The unions make it impossible to downsize and get rid of people. Now hospitals have they're under very tight financial pressure. They get paid based on a diagnosis, not based on how much is actually spent caring for a patient. So their prime motive is to try to get patients treated and out of the hospital as quickly as possible. That's the only way they're able to make a profit in the hospital business. So they pressure doctors to get patients out quickly. So if you're working for the hospital, you're under pressure from them to limit your length of stay. And the hospitalists in particular who are paid by the hospital are rabid about getting these patients out of the hospital. And that, of course, may not be good for the patient. Interestingly, Obamacare, PPACA, is now penalizing hospitals that have frequent readmissions. So the irony is the policies are creating the rapid discharge, and now the hospitals are getting penalized for this. So you see how the central planning of healthcare just simply is illogical, incoherent, and costs a fortune. Once you're in the hospital setting, you're going to be asked to serve on committees. Now, a lot of these committees are involved with quality initiatives, quality assessment, et cetera. Very rarely, as Dr. Orion suggested, is anything meaningful discussed at these meetings. And in fact, by removing the doctor or the other providers from the actual care of patients, they impair quality. Now, all these measures to improve quality end up in impairing quality because they take the doctor's time and take them away from the actual face-to-face interaction with the patient. quality in medicine is not about achieving some numerical benchmark. It's actually about enhancing the doctor-patient interaction. That is where quality occurs in medicine. Nothing to do with the numbers. Interestingly, we instituted an electronic system at the hospital, and we have these what we call COWs, computers on wheels that rotate around, and the nurses are behind these constantly, And the doctors are sitting in the doctor's sections, going over the computers and entering things and writing notes. The patient satisfaction survey after introduction of the electronic health record and the COW deteriorated markedly. And I think it's simply because they were seeing less and less of the doctors and less of the nurses. Now, how is the accountable care organization and how are the hospitals going to regiment and control care? They're going to implement guidelines, practice guidelines. Now, practice guidelines were not in existence when I went to medical school. They're a recent phenomenon, and they've proliferated. There are thousands, literally thousands of practice guidelines, and new ones are being formed all the time. Now, they sound innocuous, but in fact, they're quite nefarious. They are produced ostensibly to guide treatment, but are translated into mandates for treatment and are used by the payers to limit payment and to control care. They form the basis of payment for performance, and payment for performance, or P4P, as we say in the trade, is another one of these great-sounding concepts. In fact, I was shocked to see one of the people that I admire, Tim Pawlenty, has this in one of his talking points, and I'm going to have to write to him to tell him to take it out because it's a horrible system. First of all, doctors don't need to be tipped to perform well. Doctors are high-performing individuals, and we always do our best for patients within the resources and situation that we have. What has caused the fall off in quality in medicine has been the declining payment for treatment in the first place. So now you're going to say, oh, we're going to actually not pay you less if you perform according to our benchmarks. So it's going to mean getting your numbers in order, getting your guideline medicine in order. And this is clear. If you look at Don Berwick's old group, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, they're all over this. Okay, they're in the business of controlling doctors through accountable care organizations and implementation of guidelines. So guidelines are typically produced under the auspices of either a medical specialty society or by a governmental agency, such as the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. More often than not, they are at least partially, if not primarily, funded by industry, meaning pharmaceutical and other industry. And the industry clearly has a role in deciding who gets to write these guidelines, who gets to participate in these guidelines. And how do I know this? Well, I don't have any smoking gun memo that I've seen, but that's the only possible explanation when you look at the amount, the number of panelists who have very considerable ties, financial ties to the industry. I encourage you to go to the NHLBI website and look at the financial disclosure pages of those who are on the JNC, which gives guidelines for hypertension, and the cholesterol guideline people. They're all being supported largely by the industry of the drug industry that makes these products. So it's not surprising then that guidelines frequently come down on the side of very intensive treatment aimed at certain targets for, let's say, blood pressure or blood sugar, cholesterol. And it's also not a surprise that these targets are constantly shifting. And guess which way they're going? They're going down. The definition of normal blood pressure goes down every time the JNC gets together, and the definition of an acceptable LDL cholesterol goes down every time the ATP gets together. So these guidelines are supposedly evidence-based. The problem is the evidence is very often incomplete, of poor quality, or completely lacking. So they come down to the opinions of these panelists, these so-called expert panelists, who are clearly biased. Now, when you get a treatment recommendation wrong in your practice, you can always recover. You call the patient back in and you fix it. If you get a guideline wrong, you're going to harm thousands of patients. And this happened. Let me give you an example. In 2006, the guidelines for treatment of anemia in chronic kidney disease patients were published by the National Kidney Foundation based solely on observational data. In other words, not good experimental design. They recommended a target hemoglobin of 11 to 13. Later that year, two prospective studies, in other words, controlled trials that were well-designed, showed that the treatment towards a higher hemoglobin target of, say, 13, not only didn't improve any outcome, but actually worsened side effects, and in one of the studies caused higher mortality. So there was a brouhaha after this data was published, because it conflicted so dramatically with the NKF recommendations. And it came out, of course, that NKF was heavily funded by the company that makes the anemia-treating drug, and obviously they stood to gain heavily by this. This incident also led to a major change in the way government pays for dialysis services, and it's certain that patients over many years were harmed by being treated towards this very high hemoglobin target that was not only unrealistic, but harmful. So treatment guidelines for hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, low bone density, and other conditions are also flawed in the same way and biased towards more intensive and aggressive treatment of who many people who are really healthy, who are not getting any benefit from treatment and who only have the potential to be harmed. And this is how we are going to be treated in the future under Obamacare. We're going to be treated according to public health measures, looking at large population-based studies, which is fundamentally bad medicine when you are looking at trying to treat an individual and trying to pick out an individual who is going to benefit from treatment. So I think that I will stop there. I think that the only hope for our patients is to maintain a private medical sector to take care of patients on an individual basis. And those who are going to stay in the private sector are going to be forced into a concierge model where they get paid a supplement, in other words, a retainer, or they're going to be just billing their patients directly. These are the only models that are going to survive the current payment structure. I only hope that they are allowed to continue.
First, if you have any questions for Congressman Burgess, who has something else to do at 10 o'clock, let's take those questions first.
Well, as you know, there is a lot of preventive care actually written into law. The question is it the right type of preventive care, and is it being applied at the right place and the right time? And as has been pointed out, a lot of that is not evidence-based, it's politically based on what people thought was a good idea. And people here, I should define, is not people who populate my committee or any other House committee. It's not even people who populated a Senate committee. It is the Senate Finance Committee staff who wrote this law that came out of Harry Reid's left desk drawer on Christmas Eve and was passed by the Senate and then subsequently was the one that went down for the signing ceremony. It's not evidence-based. And that, you know, Dr. Ireland brings up a great point about the whole concept of the readmissions. Now, former Secretary of Health and Human Services Mike Leavitt, who I hold in very high regard, we disagree about the future of fee-for-service, but that's a separate story. But his notion of maybe practices could do things better if they were allowed to think about how to do things better. He created the Physician Group Practice Demonstration Project. Yes, that does involve some gain sharing, but the idea was to allow them to have some incentive for trying to do things better. And one of the great revelations from the Physician Group Practice Demonstration Project was if you carefully manage the care of the congestive heart failure patient who has decompensated, been hospitalized, if at that point you're careful about the subsequent intervals of care, you can significantly reduce those rehospitalizations, and those rehospitalizations tend to be very expensive. So this involved really some simple things, getting the patient back in to be re-evaluated within 5 days. We all learned in our residency, RTC 2 weeks, return to clinic in 2 weeks' time. That's how we practice, and I did it too. But if you were aggressive about getting that patient back in 5 days' time, you could, in fact, identify the non-complier. You could identify someone who perhaps had something that you missed during their hospitalization that was now worsening. But nevertheless, you could, on a management basis, affect those things and reduce the likelihood of rehospitalization. So what do we do with that information when you give it to us as legislators? Well, the only thing we can do is make it punitive. And if it is better that you're not rehospitalized, we're going to punish you if you rehospitalize. So we only pay for one hospitalization a month. That's the goofiest thing we could have come up with, but nevertheless, when you allow us to think about it in terms of groupthink, that's the sort of thing that happens. And I'm afraid the same sort of stuff has happened with some of the preventive care guidelines. Again, you get into treating a hemoglobin A1C and not the patient who happens to be afflicted with diabetes.
Excellent points. The patient with congestive heart failure, well, how does he get to have congestive heart failure? Well, most commonly, they've developed heart disease, coronary heart disease, through years of poor eating habits and no exercise. They have allowed themselves to develop the metabolic syndrome with type 2 diabetes and hypertension and vascular disease. Well, we know how to prevent that. It's very easy. Diet and exercise. The obstacle, I believe, to preventive care is patients. Patients are not motivated because they feel that we're going to somehow bail them out. Also, they're not spending anything on their health care. At least they don't see that they are. In reality, they are. You know, you have a employer-provided health insurance policy, that's $15,000 to $20,000 a year that you would otherwise be getting as salary. So you are paying for it, but most people are not aware of that. So they feel that the healthcare system is going to bail them out. They're going to bypass their coronary arteries and treat their heart failure and treat their diabetes. If they had some participation in the cost of their care up front, they would take much better care of themselves. And it's not hard. We know how to do this. It's very simple. You eat right and you exercise.
Let me just make one point on, you know, and you talked, both of you talked about this on the movement of doctors from individual practices to working in the hospitals. And you know, a lot of people ask me, how come when this was done, and it was such an extensive rework of the American healthcare system, how come liability reform was not included at some level? And the president makes some notional gesture towards it with $25 million, but we all know that's just window dressing. Now, here's another thought. The reason that liability reform was left out of this is, what better way to get, you identified that group of doctors that used to go into private practice that are now 60%, you said, was going into a hospital-based right. practice because you are covered under that institutional liability process. Mm-hmm. If you provide some type of backstop or protection from a liability front, you're going to, in fact, impede that movement of doctors from their own practices to an institutional practice. If you can practice under an institutional permit and have that protection from liability, that's going to be a big draw. And in some cases, it's even a bigger draw than the money, because, as we all know, that increasing liability pressure, well, your part of the world, what does it cost, $200,000 a year for an OB-GYN to have liability insurance?
Yes.
I've got to tell you, that's a lot of night work to get that $200,000 figure, which is the minimum that you have to have to protect your own financial future if you're going to go and make money in a private practice setting. Far easier to go and work as a hospitalist in a labor and delivery unit and not have to worry about that $200,000 expense that you've got to meet before you see your first patient.
The gentleman in the back had a question.
I'll give you two quick vignettes, and I'll do my best to condense them down. One from the private side, from the insurance side, one from the public side, the Medicaid side. First, from the private side, I had a patient who delivered, second baby, but actually came in to labor and delivery because she was sick that night, and sick with what looked like at first viral gastroenteritis, but as the night wore on and as her labor progressed, it almost looked like she had cholera. She was so ill with whatever this was. And of course, it didn't stop after the baby was born. Lost some blood at delivery, small woman, small blood volume, dehydrated. No way in the world to pull her IV and send her home, but the HMO that she was on says you get one day after delivery on your second baby. So it's a Saturday afternoon. I'm up with her all night, all through the morning, you know, terribly worried about you know, what is the diagnosis here was of course what was driving me crazy, and calling infectious disease specialists at the medical school and trying to find out if there's some test I need to be doing or some treatment I need to be providing that I'm not. And then in the middle of all that, I get this call from the medical director. You know, get this lady out of the hospital. Are you swinging nuts? No, I'm not getting her out of the hospital. She could die if I sent her home. And we went round and round with this discussion, and finally, you know, he said, look, either you discharge that patient from the hospital or I want your resignation on my desk first thing Monday morning. And I took the John Wayne approach, like, you don't have to wait till Monday morning, buddy. You tell me where you are right now and I'll provide you that resignation and deliver it in a way that would be meaningful to you. Now, on the public side, you know, although they don't have quite the same power to tell you to discharge a patient from the hospital, this was a different situation. A patient brought to me from jail who really had a non-emergent problem but was at term with her pregnancy. after I said, well, I need to keep her in the hospital for observation, then the jail decided they didn't want any more to do with her, and she was now my problem. But of course, she had nowhere to go, no money, no family. It's, you know, a few days before Thanksgiving. The very long story is that, yeah, I did, she was near term, I went ahead and induced her, had a healthy baby, but then what am I gonna do with her? Her family's in Kansas, I'm in Lewisville, Texas, which is just north of Fort Worth. I can't put her on a bus with a brand new baby, so I kept her in the hospital for 2 days around Thanksgiving to give her at least the amount of time to get her baby well established and bond, and then get on the bus and go home and hopefully have a nice life. Well, a year and a half later, I get a call from a medical director at the state Medicaid office. He said, Dr. Burgess, we are going to charge you with an avoidable day. I said, what the hell is an avoidable day? Well, a day that the patient didn't need to be in the hospital. So we went round and round about what was the best care for this patient, and I did the best that I could under the circumstances at the time, and of course, there was no one from the Medicaid system with which to consult over Thanksgiving of that year, which I pointed out at several occasions. But the bottom line was, well, what's the upshot of having an avoidable day? Well, nothing. It's just we're charging you with an avoidable day. Well, you know, here you have the two systems, both the public and the private, that are not really working in the patient's best interest. You had an energetic and engaged doctor on the ground who was trying to do the best possible for his patients and was actually being thwarted by one time the private system and the other side the public system. But here's the deal, and both of these doctors have said so. If you let the patient let the doctor and the patient work out what is best for them, most of the time they're going to come to the right conclusion. They're going to come to a cost-effective conclusion. It would have been much more expensive if I'd send that lady home with cholera and she'd come back moribund to the emergency room and required hours and hours of resuscitative care to put her back together. Far better to keep her in the hospital and keep her hydrated and supportive care until the crisis has passed. But I'm sure you guys have vignettes from your practices as well. But those are two that just come to mind. And it's not necessarily that the private insurance is bad or that public insurance is bad. The problem is if you put a wall in between the doctor and the patient, that's where the difficulty is going to come.
Thank you very much. We are at 10 o'clock, and we would be glad to remain to answer further questions. But I know many of you have other things to do.